What we eat and what our bodies do with our food has become a major topic in recent years because so many people are overweight, especially in this country. Our next guest met a lot of them through his medical practice, and he just can't bring himself to blame infants for their own obesity. They really have not developed eating habits yet. Dr. Robert Lustig writes of this and more in his book, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease, now in paperback. Robert Lustig is professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco, and director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health, or WATCH, program at UCSF. Before coming to San Francisco, he worked at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. Dr. Lustig, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
So when the federal government recently recommended this big decrease in sugar intake, what was your reaction?
Well, I'll tell you, it's been a long time coming. The federal government has had these recommendations by the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee for at least 10 years, and I believe 15. And they have deep-sixed it all the previous times. Every 5 years, you know, they make the recommendations, and every time the federal government has basically dispensed with it. And the reason is because the food industry didn't like them. Well, for the first time, the federal government actually stood up to the food industry and said, the data are incontrovertible. We have causation for sugar and diabetes and heart disease, and we have indirect data for cancer and dementia, and the data are too strong, and we're not going to cave this time. So I actually, you know, I'm not going to tell you that the dietary guidelines are great. There are a lot of mistakes in it. There are a lot of things I still disagree with. But at least they called out the two things that we have causation for disease. One is sugar, and the other one is sodium. And they said, we need upper limits on these two things. And so I applaud the USDA for sticking up for the American people and battling back the entrenched special interests.
You do have some targets in the book, the food industry certainly, but the regulators among them, and so it's good to hear you found some ground to find common ground with them now.
They have not been helpful to the American public, but now I think just due to the overwhelming pressure and the overwhelming volume of data, and also, you know, a seed change in the way Americans view food and disease because of what's happened here in America, people, you know, are starting to get it. You know, it can't just be diet and exercise because it doesn't work. And people are starting to recognize, you know, it just doesn't work. And what we've been told for the last 40 years, you know, is really a crock of hooey, and people are getting that. And so they're demanding something different. And finally, the policymakers, the regulators, are waking up and realizing they got to do something.
So now to the people they're regulating. I mean, you write that food is sustenance, not a drug, but it's been reformulated to be addictive. How?
Indeed. You know, the fact of the matter is, coca leaves are a medicinal. Cocaine is a drug. You know, opium was a medicinal. Morphine is a drug. You know, same with alcohol. You know, when you purify it, you change the properties. And the same thing has happened with sugar cane and sugar. So when we refined it, when we crystallized it, when we made it immediately available in 5-pound bags, we started having a problem. And then we started putting it in all the foods that we didn't even know had it before. And now we have a pandemic.
Well, and this pandemic is obesity, and you hang a lot on obesity.
No, the pandemic is not obesity.
What is it?
Everyone thinks it's about obesity. It's not about obesity. Let me explain why. So if you look at all the countries in the world, obesity versus diabetes, there are countries that are obese without being diabetic, like Iceland, Mongolia, Micronesia, and there are countries that are diabetic without being obese, like India, Pakistan, China. India and China have 12% prevalence of diabetes, and they're not fat. We are the fattest nation in the world, and we have a 9.3% diabetes prevalence. How come they have more diabetes than we do if they're not fat? Number two, obesity is increasing at the rate of 1% per year worldwide. Diabetes is increasing at the rate of 4% per year worldwide. If diabetes were just a subset of the obese population, how could you explain that? Well, you can't. Number three, if you look at the secular trends in diabetes prevalence in this country, they've been going up 25%. 25% in the obese population and 25% in the normal weight population. If obesity is the driver, how come the thin people are getting as diabetic as the obese at the same rate? It doesn't work. Yes, obesity is a problem. I'm not saying it's not. But obesity is not the cause of this problem. Obesity is a marker for the metabolic dysfunction. Diabetes is another marker for the metabolic dysfunction. Obesity doesn't cause diabetes. Obesity is a marker for diabetes.
Well, let's talk about the metabolic. I want to talk about the metabolic part of this, which is your wheelhouse, your strong suit here.
That's right.
A lot of insulin production going on in human. In fact, something you compared about adolescents now versus 40 years ago, very different levels of insulin just in that same population.
Exactly. If you look at glucose tolerance tests that were done on normal people back in 1975, they released insulin to a level of about 50. And if you look at the same data in the 1990s, they released insulin to about 100. And now if you look at those same patients and what their glucose tolerance tests look like today, they release insulin to a level of about 175. How did we get from a peak of 50 to a peak of 175 in 40 years? That's because our livers and our mitochondria in our cells are now under stress and under strain. They are now not working as well. And so your pancreas has to make more insulin to make the rest of the body do its job. That is a sign of the metabolic dysfunction, and it has happened over the last 40 years, not just in obese people, but in normal weight people too. We're all under increased metabolic stress, and that is now showing up in all of these chronic diseases that even normal weight people get.
We'll talk more about the sources of the metabolic stress and why we're changing. Dr. Robert Lustig's book is called Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Dr. Lustig and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the endocrinologist and pediatrician, Dr. Robert Lustig. He's the author of the book Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease, now in paperback. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So the idea of people getting metabolic disease, more of it, what are the causes then, do we think? You mentioned differences in society, stress for one.
Right. So obviously people say, well, this is about obesity, you know, and the obesity causes the development of cytokines like TNF-alpha and IL-6. These are proteins that circulate in the blood that make you sick. And that's true, and I'm not arguing that that's true. But the fact is, then, how do you explain the normal weight people? Okay, how do you explain the fact that India and China have this? How do you explain what's going on all over the world? Because that's not what's going on. So what we did to try to answer that question is we took 43 children with metabolic syndrome, so obesity plus another comorbidity, and 27 Latino, 16 African American, so disadvantaged youth, eating processed food as, you know, normal standard fare at their homes. And what we did was for 10 days, we catered their meals. We catered their meals to be exactly the same as their home meals. Same fat content, same protein content, same total calorie content, so they wouldn't lose weight. We gave them a scale, and they weighed themselves each day. And if they were losing weight, we said, eat more. But within carbohydrate, what we did was we took the sugar out, and we put the starch in. We did a starch-for-sugar exchange. We took the, for instance, we took the donuts out, we put the bagels in. We took the sweetened yogurt out, we put the baked potato chips in. We took the chicken teriyaki out, we put the turkey hot dogs in. In other words, we gave them crappy food, we gave them processed food, we gave them kid food, but we gave them no added sugar food, and we substituted starch. And then we reassessed them 10 days later. Every aspect of their metabolic health got better. Everything. Their blood pressure went down 5 points. Their blood glucose went down 5 points. Their insulins went down 25%. Their triglycerides went down 33 points. Their LDL, the bad cholesterol, went down 10 points. They had a lactate level. Now, lactate is only when you're exercising or when you have cancer, but these kids had a lactate level, and that went away as well. And most importantly, their subcutaneous fat did not change because they didn't lose weight, but their visceral fat, the belly fat, went down 7%, and more importantly, their liver fat went down 22% in just 10 days on the same number of calories. We fixed their metabolic disease. We reversed their metabolic dysfunction with no change in calories and no change in weight, just by getting rid of the added sugar.
Here's a question from Joe in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Robert Lustig.
Yeah, it's great chatting with Dr. Lustig. It's a true honor. My question was, I know that you've talked about the how fructose can only be dealt with the liver, and in your last comment on how just putting in starches, which is breaks down to glucose, actually improves the body because you're not getting that hit of the fructose. I was wondering, I had heard that going on a ketogenic diet, which is basically low carb and high fat, that the Eskimos don't have an issue of scurvy, even though they don't have high vitamin C levels, is because they don't have the sugar, and therefore they don't run into that issue. And I didn't know if the doctor knew anything about that.
All right, thanks
for
the question.
I know a little bit about that, and that's probably true. You know, the fact of the matter is, what is vitamin C? Vitamin C, it's ascorbic acid. It is an antioxidant. It is an antioxidant. And you only need antioxidants when you are having oxidative stress. So what is the source of oxidative stress? Is it fat? No, because that's what the Eskimos eat, is all that fat, right? The whale blubber. You know, that's what the Inuit lived on, was whale blubber. And they did just fine. The oxidative stress comes from what happens when you metabolize carbohydrate. And very particularly glucose, because glucose causes 7 times the oxidative stress of fructose does. Fructose causes 7 times the oxidative stress as glucose. So when the Eskimos got sugar introduced into their diet, which came, you know, basically in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, now they've got a massive problem. And I've been up in Alaska, and I have seen what is going on. And I have seen, because they don't have fresh food all the time, they don't go out and ice fish like they used to. You know, basically their culture has changed in part because of what has happened, you know, to their societies. And they are now getting sick. And what are they being plied with? Unbelievable in terms of the processed food and the soft drinks. I have a picture of a convenience store in Huslia, Alaska, and what it looks like, and it is a disaster. So your point is very well taken and not wasted on me.
Dr. Robert Lustig, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book Fat Chance, now out in paperback. We have him for a few more minutes. The four foodstuffs of the apocalypse, you write: trans fat, alcohol, branched-chain amino acids, and fructose. Voldemort on this list is fructose. What's the story? How did it become so indispensable to the food industry?
Well, when we went low-fat, you know, low-fat tastes like cardboard. It tastes horrible. You know, tastes like dishwater. And the food industry had to do something to make the food palatable. So there have been several things that have gone along over the years that have caused us to double down on this issue, you know, at different times. And the bottom line is we have substituted sugar for fat in our diet. And by doing so, we took something that was, for the most part, benign and even helpful. That is, certain fats are actually necessary and essential. And in its place, we substituted something that was eminently dangerous. And we have all gotten sick because of it. because of the changes in our dietary guidelines. And the thing is that we knew this back in 1977, and politics took over and forced it anyway because the food industry saw an in to be able to increase its profits.
So does this put you in the position then of saying eat more fat and less sugar?
Well, what it puts me in the position of is eat real food, because the fat that comes in real food is not concerning. Now, there are fats that are concerning, like, for instance, trans fats. Trans fats are a disaster. The trans fats are synthetic, and you don't find trans fats in real food. The good news is that after 25 years of study after study after study showing that trans fats were the devil incarnate, were consumable poison, the FDA finally in 2013, declared trans fats not generally recognized as safe. Why did it take 25 years for that to happen? Very simple. Because the food industry didn't want it to happen. That's why. We have a USDA and an FDA that are co-opted by the food and drug industries. They are what are known as agency capture, because the people at the top come from those industries and then go back to those industries. So we have a revolving door that allows for those two agencies to do their industry's bidding. We have to take this back. And until we do, we will continue to have problems.
I've always wondered about how we go about that, though, because it seems like you need to have regulators who know something about the industries they're regulating, but the idea of them constantly moving from regulator to regulatee is not necessarily the best situation either.
Indeed. I personally think that what we ought to have is, instead of people coming from those industries, what we ought to have is fast-track people who stay within the government and, you know, basically, are provided, shall we say, protection from those industries in terms of the work they do. One of the people who absolutely needs to be protected is the Surgeon General. Right now, the Surgeon General is a medical spin doctor and is basically subservient to whatever Health and Human Services say they have to do. And that is just not right. The Surgeon General is America's physician and needs to do the right thing on the basis of public health and cannot be subservient to what Congress and HHS tell him what to do. He needs to be a clear, independent thought and mind, but that's not what we have.
So lacking in our own personal lives the ability to have much control over that on an immediate basis, what do we do about our own situation? You mentioned it's not just diet and exercise, but that's a suggestion in the book that fiber and exercise might be a little more along the right pathway?
Basically, what we need is a low-sugar, high-fiber diet. That has a name. It's called real food. Okay, processed food is high-sugar, low-fiber, but that's what the food industry is selling. So what we need to do is we need to educate people as to the difference between the two and why processed food isn't food. And we need to have policies that allow people to be able to access real food and be able to afford real food. The problem, of course, is that with subsidies, we only subsidize those things that go into processing, corn, wheat, soy, and sugar. So we right now have a government administrative scheme, paradigm, that basically rewards the food industry for doing the wrong thing and making America sick. What we have to do is we have to reformulate what we're doing. We have to provide a business incentive for the food industry to do the right thing, because ultimately they do want to do the right thing, but they want to make money more than they want to do the right thing. So we have to make them want to do both. And the only way to do that is to actually get rid of the subsidies, because that's what's driving this. So how do you get rid of subsidies? Well, that's a tough one, because obviously there are a lot of states that are very dependent on this. I show a slide of the United States, and it's a slide of federal subsidies versus profits made by industry. And there's a big hole in the middle of Iowa. I mean, it's a big black hole. And no one wants to piss off Iowa. Why? You're going to find out in 2 weeks.
With the caucuses.
No one wants to piss off Iowa because they're the first presidential caucus.
Wow. Do you hold that much hope that that things will change quickly? Or are they changing? Let's put it that way.
Well, let's put it this way. It took 20 years for the USDA to acknowledge that sugar was a problem, but they have. It took FDA 40 years to acknowledge that tobacco was a problem, but they did. Right? They are educable, and when there's enough voter anger and when there's enough pressure that's brought to bear from the outside, that's when politicians change. Remember, politicians lead from behind. Okay, we have to be out there doing the good work and getting our politicians to change. That's what I'm doing, and that's what I hope your listeners understand. And if they do understand that, then and they want their voice to be heard, let me give you a way to do it. Log on to the following website, www.responsiblefoods.org. This is a nonprofit that we have set up called the Institute for Responsible Nutrition, and our job is to take on big food.
Responsiblefoods.org. Okay. The book is called Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Dr. Robert Lustig wrote it. It's out in paperback now. Dr. Lustig, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
All right. Take care.